Check, check, check. You want to make some sounds?
Okay. Is it working, Shannon?
Yep.
All right.
All right. Very good. Okay, so this is Gregory Rosenthal interviewing Jerry Jennings. It's February 23rd, 2016. We are in Mr. Jennings' home in Raleigh Court. Is that, or is it not Raleigh Court?
It's kind of on the edge of Raleigh Court. So it's kind of like, it's
south,
kind of between Raleigh Court and Windsor Hills.
Windsor Hills.
Yeah.
Okay, and this is for the Southwest Virginia LGBTQ History Project Oral History Initiative, and that's it. So, Jerry, if you will, just state your name and where you grew up.
Okay, Jerry Jennings, and I grew up here in the Roanoke Valley. Was born in Roanoke City, lived there till I was about 8, and then we moved into Roanoke County, and then I lived there until, you know, through college and. Until I moved out on my own when I was 24, I think.
So you were born in the 50s?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you said you moved to the county when you were 8?
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit about that first period, those first 8 years in Roanoke City. You went to, did you go to public elementary school?
I did. First and second grade in Roanoke City. They didn't have public kindergarten back then, so I went to a private kindergarten.
What was your home like? Siblings? What did your parents do?
I have one sister who's 3 years younger. And my parents were, my mom had been a teacher before I was born, and she didn't work until, again, after I was born, she didn't go back to work until I was maybe 14 or 15, something like that. My dad worked for the U.S. government, for the Internal Revenue Service. So it was just the four of us in the family.
Were your folks from this area or moved
here?
Yes,
they were.
So, and what propelled you into that county? Was that a change in job or just a change in location?
Just a bigger, newer house. The house that we had in the city was a small kind of little Cape Cod. And we moved into a ranch that had, I guess, 7 rooms or something. So, in fact, my sister still lives in the house. When our parents died, she bought my share, and so she's still there. And it's only just over the hill from here. It's very close.
What neighborhood were you in the city when you were?
Granite Court. Okay. Yeah.
So what school did you go to then for the rest of your schooling, the K through 12?
More first through 12.
Well, first and second were Granite Court Elementary. Third was Cave Spring Elementary. Then they changed the district lines. We didn't move again, but they changed the lines. So then I went to Mount Vernon Elementary School, 4th through 7th grade. And then when I went into 8th grade, that was the first year that they had a what was then called an intermediate school or a junior high school, basically. So I went to 8th grade at the intermediate school and then Cave Spring Intermediate and then 9th grade through graduation at Cave Spring High School.
What was Cave Spring like? Would you say was, what was the community like? Suburban?
Very suburban, very middle class. There were a lot of kids too, though, who were kind of from the country, probably whose families had lived in Roanoke County, in Southwest Roanoke County for many, many years. And then there were lots of, you know, these suburban kids whose, you know, parents were many who had transferred here for jobs, with GE or the railroad or things like that. There were 1,600 kids there at the time. And I think there were maybe 100 black kids. and maybe two Asian kids. I mean, it was very, very white, homogeneous student body. Not to mention the teachers, they were all white too, just about.
What year did you graduate from Kansas?
1972.
So I'd imagine the schools were integrated sometime during your, like, sometime during your middle school or sometime in there.
Well, I'm not 100%. I mean, it was actually before, when I was in elementary school, because I know that this was a Roanoke County school, if I'm talking about now. There was one black kid in sixth and seventh grade. So at that point, at least, we were integrated in some respect. I don't know if it was full, I don't know what the particulars were, but now Roanoke City schools, I think, integrated maybe a little bit later than that. Because I remember hearing stories about Patrick Henry High School, which actually I lived closer to, even though I was in the county, I lived closer to Patrick Henry than Cave Spring. But I remember hearing stories about what was going on with Patrick Henry integrating.
So you were in high school, I guess, from 68 to 72?
Mm-hmm.
Those were tumultuous, tumultuous years in the country.
It certainly
were. What was it like in Cave Spring?
I remember the first Earth Day. We had our first Earth Day, I think it was 1970, and several of us decided we were going to celebrate or recognize it by walking to school instead of taking the bus. So we walked. It was, I don't know, 2 or 3 miles, something like that, probably 3 miles. And I remember going to a couple of war protests. And I remember we first celebrated Black History Month while I was in high school. So there was that sort of stuff, but it was pretty low key. It wasn't any big drama that I recall, anyway. Probably the bigger, but rather than the political side of things, the bigger changes were coming about in society, as far as the hippies and long hair and all that stuff, and I was not really part of that at all. I was a goody two shoes.
Were there hippies at Cave Spring?
Oh yeah, oh sure. Oh yeah, the freaks. They were kind of the shorthand to refer to them.
So what kind of kid were you in those teenage years?
Oh, I was a real goody-two-shoes. I was in the band, and I was on the student newspaper. I was in the Latin club, so those were my extracurriculars. I was a pretty nerdy kid, pretty shy kid.
Did you have any sense of your sexuality at high school?
Yeah, the very beginnings. I mean, I think I was probably about 16 when I actually understood what was going on in that respect for me. But, of course, it was, there was no public discussion of that topic. So it was, there was really no outlet that I knew of. Now, of course, I know now there was some of the things we were talking about a little earlier before we started recording about the Gay Alliance and the Big Lick Gazette and stuff like that that was beginning to happen when I was still in high school. But, of course, I had no knowledge of that.
You were certainly not yet going to bars or anything like that.
No.
So
no.
Probably hard to meet anyone who was openly gay. Were there students at Cave Spring who were gay?
There certainly were. I don't know if they were acting on it at the time, but yeah, several of my friends from high school later came out. But I remember one time earlier than high school probably, when my dad worked downtown. His office was downtown. And so we would go and meet him at the old S&W cafeteria downtown for dinner a lot, but pretty frequently. And of course, back, you know, in the 60s, there were malls. The malls were beginning, but it was still a lot of, you know, retail and stuff activity going on downtown. So anyway, we would go down there a lot. And I remember when we would drive home, we would drive up Franklin Road out of downtown and we would go by the Trade Winds. Well, I, of course, didn't know anything about the Trade Winds. And I don't know what my parents said about the Trade Winds while we passed it. But I remembered thinking that there was something wrong with that place because of the way they talked about it. So they knew, I guess, what kind of place it was. And of course, the Trade Winds, as I understand it, the Trade Winds was there from the 40s and was a gay bar even throughout that period. So have you heard some or learned some about that? Anyway, it was just interesting that I knew there was something shady about the place before I knew what it was.
I'm just trying not to hit the table. What's your memory of that space? Did it, when you're driving by on Franklin, did it have an aura of secretiveness to it, or skeeviness, or something? Is there something that would make your parents, you know, be like, that place ain't right?
Just by looking at it? I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, it had a big sign, Trade Winds, and I think it had a palm tree on the sign. And, no, I don't think it was anything, you know, particularly skeevy looking about it. Although it was, you know, it was in old, kind of on the border between downtown and Old Southwest. And Old Southwest was, you know, kind of on the shady side in those years. So I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but it was basically downtown. I mean, it was just right on the edge, you know.
Could you elaborate on your thinking about that time, early 70s, maybe, what Old Southwest was, what was its reputation, what was it like?
Well, at the time, I didn't know anything about it. Although my parents had friends who lived there, and close friends who lived there, and so we would go there and visit, and they lived in an apartment upstairs in a house. And I think that they owned the house, but I don't really know. But aside from that, I mean, I didn't really know anything about Old Southwest. That changed when I moved out of the house. I moved to Old Southwest when I was 24. So I was, at that point, was certainly aware of it and was involved in the neighborhood organization and stuff.
So take me back now to high school. You graduated in 72. What was next for you at that time?
I went to college. I went to University of Virginia in Charlottesville. I was there all 4 years. So I majored in psychology with no particular idea of what I was going to do when I came out.
What was it like at Charlottesville in those years?
You know, there was a lot of stuff to be exposed to, like, and I guess just about anybody who goes off to college is going to experience. In those days, you know, I think maybe it's probably more true than now that, in fact, I'm sure it is, that, you know, somebody in that position gets exposed to a lot more stuff that they've never even thought of. But it was a little bit overwhelming for me. At first, I was glad to be kind of anonymous. I mean, it was, you know, there were 16,000 students there when I was there, in undergrad and grad together. It's a lot bigger now, but so I liked being anonymous. But then I sort of I never really got into a good groove there. I mean, my grades were okay and all that, but my grandmother died on November 1st of my first year at UVA, and I think that and I was very close to her. And I think that had an impact that, you know, probably for a year or so, that had a pretty major impact on me. I'm not really sure how, except I didn't take my father's advice, and when I went to UVA, I decided to room with my best friend from high school. And he said, don't do it, because if you do that, you're not going to meet as many people. And he was right. I didn't meet as many people. And so it was, socially, it was sort of a, you know, I mean, I had fun and everything, but it was somewhat limited, I think, from what it could have been if I'd had a little wider circle than I started off with. But it was, you know, I liked it. I liked UVA. I enjoyed it. You know, I certainly became more aware, politically aware, and so forth. When I, 72 was the first year I was able to vote for president, and I voted for Nixon. Haven't voted for a Republican for president since then, but you know, by that point I was beginning to, you know, as I said, I was beginning to be more politically aware. And Chuck Robb was in law school at UVA at the time, and he was head of the, I think they call it the Student Legal Forum. And so they brought in speakers. Well, he, of course, had pretty good connections, being the son-in-law of President Johnson. So he brought in, they brought in all these, you know, big names in politics. The one I remember the most was Hubert Humphrey. And so that was, you know, that was an interesting part of it, to begin to see some of these national figures speak.
I'm interested in your political awakening, because you said back at Cape Spring that you went to some anti-war demonstrations and Earth Day and so on. Did you at that time, did you feel like you understood your political values, that they had formed yet? Or was that more, hey, people are coming, going to this thing, you want to tag along?
Well, it was some of that, yeah. I had a couple of close friends who were really, really into the anti-war stuff, and so I tagged along with them to some extent. But it was, I mean, my political ideas were not well-formed at all. You know, I think that my thoughts at the time about Nixon and McGovern were just that the things that McGovern was saying just didn't seem realistic to me. But that was about the extent of my, you know, that was the entire depth of my understanding about it, I think, was that.
What kind of values did your parents have and raise you with in terms of, was it a religious household, or were your parents politically aligned in any direction?
It was not a religious household. My mother, that's funny, I was thinking about this last night. My mother would, a lot of times on Sunday morning, she would say, well, we really ought to go to church today. But then, you know, she would just sit there, and the rest of us would sit. I mean, she didn't push it. I think she just felt, you know, the social obligation. But so we belonged to a church, to a Presbyterian church, first to a Baptist church, then a Presbyterian church, but we didn't go much at all. And they never mentioned religion other than that. I mean, and, you know, didn't say grace and didn't, you know, it's very, very non-religious kind of upbringing. And they were, you know, they were Southern people, and, you know, they were, you know, their ideas about race were not hateful, but were not enlightened at all. You know, it was, and of course in those years, a lot of the changes that were happening in, as far as race relations were playing out on television and with TV characters or just guests on talk shows and that kind of stuff. And so we had some debates in the house about that, you know, mom and dad kind of kind of thought that some of that was being forced on society, and you know. But they, as I said, they were not hateful at all, not at all about as far as race went or anything for that matter.
And you didn't have any conversations about sexuality
before
leaving home?
No, I didn't. In fact, I hadn't come out to anybody until my one friend, Kathy, who was a very close friend in high school and again at UVA, she was the first puncher I ever came out to, and she was very accepting, and then there was one other girl, young woman, who I was very close to, and she was kind of pressuring me because she wanted us to be dating and she wanted to be involved, and of course I wasn't interested in that, although we did have sex twice, as it turned out, after I moved out of my parents' house. But I wanted to move out of my house into my own place before I told her, because I thought that it would be very upsetting for me if she didn't, if she didn't take it well. And she did. She did take it pretty well, and at least overtly. So anyway, yeah, I was out of the house at 24 and in an apartment. And then also was coming out kind of socially, at that point in like November of 1978.
Now you lived in the dorms at UVA?
First year, I did. They didn't have dorm space for anybody but first year students then. They had a little bit for upperclassmen, but very few. Very little space for upperclassmen, and I wanted to stay on grounds and go in the dorm, but I didn't get picked in the lottery to do that. So I had an apartment the rest of the 3 years.
And then when you graduated, you moved back to Roanoke, you were saying, and you lived at home for a little bit longer before you...
Yeah, for 2 more years. I stayed in Charlottesville through the summer after graduating in 1976 because we had the apartment until August, or through August. And I had a job there. I worked as a clerk in Miller & Rhodes department store in downtown Charlottesville. I worked at Miller & Rhodes here during breaks and during summers through college. And so did that up there full-time for that summer.
Was there any kind of gay group, student group at UVA in those years? Were you involved?
No. There was a gay student union, but I wouldn't have touched it with a 10-foot pole. It just didn't seem like an option, even somehow. I mean, I knew what they were about, and I knew what was really going on with me, but I was just not ready to deal with that at all. And I had a couple of come-ons from guys who were friends of mine who turned out to be gay later, and I was like, just kind of ignored it or brushed it aside or whatever. Just wasn't ready.
That first female friend that you came out to, that was at UVA, or that was after?
It was after we were at UVA, yeah. Yeah, I think she too had wanted something more than a friendship. But it didn't happen.
So when you moved back to Cape Spring in 76, I guess, or 76?
Yeah.
Late 76?
Yeah. September 76.
Moved back home. So then what were you up to at that time? Did you go into Roanoke and explore the social world of the bars?
No. I didn't do that until 2 years later, a little over 2 years later. I was working and living at home, and I was going out to some bars, but not gay bars. still, really didn't have any knowledge about that, I don't think. and at that point.
So tell me about this moment when you decided to move out and get your own place in Old Southwest. What was that moment in your life about? What was that change about?
Well, I think it was just at the time, it just kind of felt like the natural thing to do. You know, there wasn't any problem really living at home. Mom and Dad had finished the basement, so I was in a bedroom in the basement, so I had a bath down there and had kind of my own space. But it just seemed, you know, it just seemed like the natural progression. But I was tying it, excuse me, to, you know, I was tying the timing of coming out, as I said, to this one girlfriend, quote unquote, to when I moved out. So I had, I guess, you know, thinking back on it now, I did have some kind of timetable in my head of moving forward, you know, once I'd moved out.
Yeah, so you're basically, you're telling this woman, this is not going to work out the way you think, and also it's an opportunity for you to come out, be more authentic in your own identity, your own life. And the way to do that was to get an apartment and move on, move forward with your life.
Yeah.
So do you remember where you lived in Old Southwest?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What street?
I was on Franklin Road in an apartment, not very close to the trade winds, a few blocks up from the trade winds, which had nothing to do with me getting that apartment. It was a nice apartment. It was, I think, four rooms. It was $125 a month, including heat. it was owned, the building was owned by the church next door, or two doors down. So it was a, I guess there were six units in the building, and I was on the first floor.
And this was 1978?
This was 19... let me think. Yeah. Yeah, it was 1978.
So, and I take it you got involved with some of the gay organizations and stuff at pretty shortly, or...
Well, there... I didn't find anything in Roanoke to get involved with. I mean, I knew about the bars, and I went to at the time when I first came out, the bar that was, I didn't know anything about the Trade Winds or the Horoscope, which I don't know if the Horoscope was still open at that point or not, but the bar that I went to first was called Murphy's. And I went there in November 78, maybe, I don't know how many times, not very many, two or three. And then the park opened in December. And then nobody ever went back to Murphy's, I don't think. But at that time, I didn't know of any organizations in Roanoke. And so I first heard about organizations in Lynchburg, or one organization called PALS, which is Positive Alternative Lifestyles. It was a support group, basically. And so every other Sunday, I would go drive to Lynchburg. And so for, I don't know, a year or two, maybe three, that was the group, the organizational involvement I had. And then we started the Blue Ridge Lambda Alliance, which was sort of intended to be the political kind of side of things. And we did. We had a telephone helpline for a long time, and did some little beginnings of some political activism. I remember doing a radio show one time in Lynchburg anonymously with someone else, but we were, you know, talking about being gay on this radio show. They had some parties that were fundraisers, and there was one particular house in Lynchburg on Harrison Street. Have you heard about this?
Yes.
Yeah. My good friend, who I guess I shouldn't name, although I know he would be delighted if I did, he owned that house, and it was a big classical kind of house, Victorian house, so he would host lots of parties there, so that was a lot of fun. And then at some point, I'm not sure when, early 80s, I guess, that's when there was some stuff happening in Roanoke. And so I kind of gradually moved from that, away from Lynchburg, and to the groups here.
It's interesting to me that you were commuting to Lynchburg for this gay community, because I think that people have a sense of Roanoke as being a kind of hub, and Lynchburg would be a more conservative place, and certainly Jerry Falwell and all those people are based there. But, I have never heard of the PALS group, which I guess you're saying is a predecessor of the Blue Ridge Lambda Alliance?
Yes.
So that PALS was in someone's home, and was it mostly men? Like, tell me a little bit about what kind of...
It was men and women. It rotated from just really two or three people's homes, I think. There would be 30, 40 people there. And sometimes we'd have a topic, and sometimes we wouldn't. But there were people, there were people the people who were running it would kind of put together programs sometimes. Sunday afternoons. Like I said, I think it was maybe like first and third Sunday, something like that. That was my first step into any kind of group thing.
Do you remember how you found out about it?
Yes. A coworker of mine at the time was seeing some guy from Lynchburg, and he told him about it.
Were there other Roanokers going out there, you think? So it was really catching people from...
Well, there were a few. There weren't many from Roanoke at first. Only this friend from work and the guy he was seeing. Who, like I said, he lived in Lynchburg anyway, so it might have just been the two of us there at the very beginning. And there really weren't that many Roanokers that went later on. There were a few, especially after when the political group started, the Blue Ridge Lambda Alliance. I remember that I would usually drive, and there would usually be four of us in the car going to meetings. And those meetings would be like on Wednesdays at 6:30 or something, so... We'd hit the road right after work, and it was... my memory is that it was every week, but I don't think it was every week. I think it must have been every couple of weeks. For a long time, like a couple or 3 years, we did this.
The Blue Ridge Lambda Alliance, what you're saying was founded in Lynchburg. Was it... Would you say it was founded in that house on Harrison Street, or is that... Okay.
Yeah.
Early 80s, like 81, 82, something like that.
And I've got the newsletters, some of the PALS. I don't have all of the PALS newsletters, but I have some of them. And then that's what evolved into the Blue Ridge Lambda Press, the Pink Pages newsletter.
What was your involvement with the shift towards the political organization? You were part of that?
Yeah, I was one of the handful that was, making that happen. But it was all under, and this has been true for my involvement all through the years. I was very kind of behind the scenes as far as the public viewpoint, or the perspective of somebody in the public. Although my name was in the newsletter, in the Lambda Press newsletter, but I never did, TV or, anything, or, press or anything like that using my name.
What were the political issues at that time, early 80s, that you felt like when you were going to PALS meetings and talking with these people, what were the issues that you felt like, hey, we need to do something different? What propelled the Blue Ridge Lambda Alliance into fruition?
I don't know. I think primarily it was just to dispel the negative impressions that were out in the culture about being gay. I think that was the main thing. We did do some candidate surveys. I think even in those early years, I think we did. But I don't, you know, half the time we didn't get responses, I think. You know, one of the things that I guess was on our minds then was that it was actually illegal to serve gay people in a bar for many years. I mean, until probably the early 90s.
Yeah.
When Mary C. Terry was Attorney General, there was a court ruling that opposed that, and then she, as I recall, she declined to appeal it, or declined to support the appeal, maybe. So that was, I think that was one thing that, you know, we were pretty taken aback by. That was messing with our social life, or potentially was.
Would you say at that time when you were involved with PALS and Blue Ridge Lambda Press, where were the key social places? I guess Murphy's closed down.
The park was pretty, well, the park was the only one I really went to. There were two or three other places in those at some point, but I don't know when, you know, The Last Straw and Backstreet, I don't know when those opened really, because I never went to them for a long time. I did eventually go to them some, but for whatever reason, I kept my social, my nightlife activity to the park. I don't know why. Now, there were some other bars that opened and closed along the way, and I did go to those some, but that was later in the 80s and the 90s, I think.
Maybe it was the dance scene at the park. Was that your scene?
Well, I did dance back then, yeah. I mean, it was where the most people were. It was, you know, back then it was almost all men. It was almost all straight. I mean, almost all gay. And then there would be hundreds of people in there. I mean, it was a very, you know, exciting place to be.
I do want to go back to Lynchburg and Blue Ridge Lambda Alliance, but a question about the park, because you said in December of 78 when it opened up, you were like, this is the place now. What was the park like at that time? What are your memories of it's what it used to be?
Right at the beginning, or just kind of in those early years?
Both.
Well, it was, you know, it was a very sexually charged atmosphere. I mean, it was not a place where, you know, there was sexual activity going on. I mean, not, there was probably a little bit in the bathroom stall or something, but not much. I mean, that wasn't you know, a real prevalent thing at all, at least not that I recall or knew of. It was just a lot of fun, you know. It was just, I mean, I would go there. They were open, you know, at the beginning, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And there were weeks that I would be there almost every one of those nights. And I lived really close to it. After, I only lived in my apartment on Franklin for about a year and a half, and then I bought a house on Marshall Avenue, which was really the urban frontier back then. And I bought this house for $16,000, and it needed some work. But it was basically livable. And then eventually I lived in that house for 13 years and did eventually do a lot of renovations in there, but it was just like, you know, 5 blocks from the park or something. So it was very handy.
Was the park?
That isn't why I bought the house there though.
Was the park a place to meet people for you, or did you go with a partner, or?
No, I didn't go with a partner. I've not had a lot of luck in the partner department over the years. But yeah, we'd go and meet a lot of people and see friends, and yeah, it was you know, social hub for me, probably more than a lot of people, more than most people, more than was healthy, probably.
So back to the Blue Ridge Lambda Alliance, Was HIV on your radar screen, like in the community at that time? Was that some of the organizing?
There wasn't a whole lot of organizing with that group around that issue. Now there was, you know, in Roanoke there was more happening with that, and that was, I remember going to some meetings about for the Roanoke AIDS Project when it first began. But I didn't stay real involved with that aspect of things. But yeah, I mean, it was certainly, you know, I remember going through some process of thinking like, well, here I've just come out and I've been enjoying all this and having a good time, and now this, you know, the gay plague has started. You know, that was a pretty shocking kind of realization, you know, that kind of gradually, you know, somewhat gradually dawned on us. But I don't really remember that being, you know, something that we were organizing around particularly.
So how did the Blue Ridge Lambda Press start? Were you involved in the mm-hmm. starting that up?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, yeah. I mentioned earlier that I went to, when I was on the school newspaper in high school, I was the editor in my senior year, so I was very involved with that, and did some of that in college at UVA, not a whole lot. I did some writing for the newspaper, the Cavalier Daily, at UVA, but then I worked in production and just did paste up for most of my involvement with that. But it was still something that I really enjoyed, and you know, and so I was probably I don't know that I was the person that was pushing to do the Lambda Press, but I was certainly one of the two or three that was very involved in getting that going. I remember subscribing to, you know, like I said, in those years there was just so little in print that I knew of, but I remember subscribing to the Gay Community News, which was published in Boston, and so I subscribed to that through the mail, because that was the first thing that I knew of, you know, the first such publication I knew about. So I was really eager to learn all of that and be exposed to that, and then expose other people to it with the Lambda Press, which was, of course, nothing in comparison to the Gay Community News of Boston, which was, you know, a full-fledged kind of newspaper, basically. But it was in our own little way, it was, you know, a good starting point.
So how often did the... Was it always Pink Pages? Was that
it? Was. It was.
So many people in the community just who have talked to me about the project say, the Pink Pages.
Yeah.
So it's always been Pink Pages.
Yeah, I would not have chosen the Pink Pages, but somebody else's opinion prevailed on that.
And how often did you put it out?
It was, I think, every 2 months, most of its life. It was every 2 months.
And how far do you... What is your sense of its circulation?
Well, it wasn't a lot. I mean, it was a few hundred. I think I don't know if we ever printed as many as 1,000. We had a mailing list. We would just, you know, anybody who wanted to, we would mail it to at no cost. And then we would distribute them in the bars. So
you would take copies down to the park and place it in mm-hmm. The Straw and Backstreet and places?
Well, I didn't go to the Straw or Backstreet much. I don't remember going there really at all in those years. Maybe the Straw a few times when I was there with some friends or something. But Backstreet, I just don't hardly ever remember being in those years. And I'm not, like I said, I'm not sure when they opened, even the Straw or Backstreet. I'm guessing it was sometime in the 80s, but I don't late 80s, probably. I don't know.
Do you know? You probably know.
Yeah. I think the Straw was early 70s.
Was it? Oh, my gosh.
Closed in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And Backstreet's been harder to pin down.
I think it opened later. I know that.
Maybe early 80s or something.
Yeah, because when I was working downtown at lunchtime, there was some other kind of establishment there. And I remember going at lunchtime with some of my guys, the other guys at work, and we would go and have a hot dog or hamburger or whatever and shoot pool or play pinball at lunchtime in that same space. So that would have been the early 80s.
What were you doing for work?
Well, I ended up in social work. I didn't plan it, but when I came out of college, I went to the Employment Commission and they said, well, go see these people at CETA, which was, I think, was a federal employment program, and it was, I think it stood for Comprehensive Employment and Training Act, CETA. So I went to CETA and they said, well, you qualify for a CETA job once you're unemployed for 30 days. So they said, come back in 30 days. So I did that, and ended up with a job as a Medicaid eligibility worker for Roanoke City DSS. And so I did that for, I think it was just 7 months, and then got a social work job there. And that was what I did for the next 17 years. But like I said, it was just chance that I ended up at that. I mean, I'd been a psychology major, so it, you know, it had some connection, you know, had some connection to that sort of thing. But yeah, so that's what I was doing.
So you mentioned that eventually the organizing, the gay organizing, moved back to Roanoke, or something happened in Roanoke. I know there's the, I'm not sure when ALGO formed, the Alliance of Lesbian and Gay Organizations. Mm-hmm. Was that in the 80s? Or?
Maybe the late 80s. I'm not sure exactly. I've probably got some documents, though, that would tell us that.
So would you say through most of the 80s you were continuing to go down to Lynchburg to work with the Blue Ridge Lambda Alliance?
I don't know about most of the 80s, maybe most of the 80s. I'm not sure exactly. But at some point we brought it to Roanoke, the Lambda Press publication we brought to Roanoke, and it was taken over by the Roanoke Valley Gay Alliance, or Roanoke Valley Gay and Lesbian Alliance. I think it had different names. And so that was kind of who published it throughout the time I was involved with it.
Did the Lambda Alliance continue on in Lynchburg? Like, did the press separate? Or, like, what did the alliance sort of dissolve in Lynchburg?
I think eventually it did. But I think they kept the gay helpline, for instance. They kept that for some years after that. I don't know how many. And that was located in this house on Harrison Street. Throughout its time, as far as I know. That got moved away in, I think it was 1986, though. I think it's when he moved. So I'm not sure after that what happened.
So you were eventually back in Roanoke working on the press in Roanoke. I don't really know anything about the Roanoke Valley Gay and Lesbian Alliance at that time here. So there was a group that was providing a home for the press. What else can you say about that gay and lesbian group?
Well, we did. That was becoming more political. I mean, we did candidate surveys. We had a name that I am going to say out loud because I'm sure you know of this fellow, Sam Garrison, who is deceased. Sam was very public, and he was kind of the public face of that group, or the most public face of that group, I should say. And there were some issues that came up like this. At one point, the police did a major crackdown on soliciting, and so there was a lot of noise. The group made a lot of noise at city council, and they sort of pulled back from that. I can't remember the specifics of it. I think there was a new ordinance maybe that was
some anti-soliciting ordinance or something that was new that they eventually repealed, I guess. I'm not sure exactly, like I said. Then we did candidate interviews. We interviewed some candidates. I remember interviewing David Bowers and Jim Trout, who was a city councilman for a number of years, who's deceased now, and a few others, and group interviews kind of things. So that was primarily, I guess, what we did. We did some stuff in Richmond. I don't know that I ever really went. I never went lobbying in Richmond, but I think some of our members did. We didn't have many members. I mean, we're talking like 6 or 8 or 10 people, right? It was never a big group.
Was it mostly men?
Yeah. It was really all men. Yeah. There were the lesbians were very separate, and you know, as I said earlier, they didn't go to the park. I don't know where they went. I know that they had a group called First Fridays that was a social group. And that, I think, went on for a number of years. I don't really know anything about, or I don't remember anything about what they, you know, where they met or how that, what the logistics of that were. But yeah, and we tried to get, you know, some of them to be involved, and we never were really very successful. That was probably, I think that was the reason that the ALGO group came about, because we wanted to try to build our numbers and gain strength, right? But that didn't last too many years either, I don't think. I think they were probably the nominal sponsor of the Pride event for part of the time. I know that they awarded the, like, I can't remember, just the ALGO Service Award or something, it was called, and I got that 1 year. I have a plaque. It's on the wall in my office back here.
Tell me about Sam. When did you meet Sam Garrison? I mean, I'll never be able to know him. What I heard is that he was a very firebrand. Yeah, it sounds like you worked alongside him for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
So how did that? How did you meet him, and what was his role in the community?
Well, I don't remember how I first met him. He was, at that time, I don't know, you probably have heard some of his background. He had, when I met him, he had been disbarred, and he had been in prison for embezzling from a client, a law client. And so he had fallen as far as you can fall. And so he was kind of newly out himself, I think, but with great gusto. He became a kind of a fitness junkie. He ran, you know, jogged. He was rail thin from that. I mean, you know, and he was very healthy looking, and was healthy as far as I know. And he was the one, I remember that Sam was the one who pushed for us to do a Pride the first time, and I was kind of skeptical that we could make that happen in a place like Roanoke, but he, you know, he was gung-ho, and of course he proved to be right on that here 30 years later or whatever.
Yeah, well, tell me about that. That was 1989, I think, the first Pride in the Park in Wasina, right?
Yeah, but I thought it was a little earlier than that, because I think we just had the 30th. Maybe I'm not right about that, though.
Well, we could easily go online and look. I think it was definitely late 80s.
Okay, yeah.
So what, what was the idea? Of course, Pride is now its own organization and carries on. What was the idea behind having a Pride in the Park? I don't know if it was called that the first time.
It was called Pride in the Park. Well, I mean, you know, we most of us had been to Washington, D.C., in particular, to the Pride up there, which was well-established and was a huge event on a large scale, and we knew that other cities, smaller cities, were doing it, beginning to do it, and so it seemed like the next step, I guess, for that to happen here.
What did you plan? What were the components of the festival?
Well, it was as you mentioned, it was in Walsena Park. It was very modest. We had volleyball and I think softball competitions, and there was a big picnic. And I think at that first one we had entertainment. We had a stage, a small stage that was brought in, and I don't know about the first year, but I know in those early years we had a variety of entertainment. We had some drag, but not all drag. We were all interested in not having all drag. we had this singing duo called Romanofsky and Phillips. I get a couple of gay guys who toured around nationally. We had these, I can't remember if they were from, I think they were from D.C., and I can't remember right off the top of my head the name of the group, but they did country dancing, and so they would do these little routines, and they had their cowboy hats and tight jeans and everything, and so it was very appealing that way, and they were fun. Gosh, I think we had, the names are really escaping me. But anyway, we had, a variety of entertainment like that in those early years. I guess similar to what they do now. We didn't have pop stars, but, we had people who were, a few national acts that we could afford.
Were you all pretty pleased with the turnout? Did you feel like it was successful? I imagine when you went into it, did you have fears about, how the city would feel about it, how the police would feel
well,
about
yeah,
it?
Well, yeah. Not so much the city, because, of course, we had to get the city's cooperation from the beginning to hold it in the park, in the city park. The biggest concern was the press, because we didn't want the press there, or we didn't want them filming there. And there was a lot of talk in those early couple or three years about, people didn't want to, would people come if they thought the press was going to be there? Would they come if they thought the TV was going to be there? I remember seeing some of the coverage where they would shoot, only shoot people from behind at a distance, or only shoot people from the waist down kind of walking or dancing or whatever, over the years, of course, that concern just went away. For the most part, over many years, actually, it took for that concern to go away, I think.
I imagine people were afraid of being outed.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah. 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 And then, and I think one of the benefits of Walsena is that it was kind of remote in a way. It's a big, I don't know if you may or may not have noticed it now. Of course, the Greenway goes right through there where we had the event, but there's a couple of picnic shelters there that are still there, and so that was kind of the base camp for it. Mm-hmm. And the stage was kind of on the other side of that from the river, and then the ball fields and stuff were right there, so it was pretty, it wasn't the easiest thing to do to just drive by and spy who was there. I don't remember if we had the road blocked off or not, but I think we probably did, except for people to park. So it was a good spot from that standpoint, to kind of lend some privacy to it.
On the other hand, I'm thinking people have told me that in the 90s that Walsena was a cruising area.
Oh, yeah.
And the police, undercover police would come through. And was that... I don't know if that's the same part of the park or in terms of location.
Probably the same stretch, because the road went where the Greenway goes now. the road went then. And in fact, part of the Greenway is still is what was the road. But the road went right by the river, and the Greenway kind of swerves around, verges around, you know, away from the river a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, it was kind of a, you know, a loop that the cruisers could make, I think, to do that. And I think that was, you know, it had that reputation for many years, and maybe even still to a degree.
Yeah, I wonder if, I just wonder if when you chose Wasina for the Pride in the Park, if that was sort of a space that the gay community, was it a gay space? Was it a space they knew of? Or was it more just, let's find a remote, some semi-remote, beautiful space to...
You know, I don't remember. I don't remember that entering into the discussion, or it may have. I just don't know. It didn't. After a few years, though, it moved to Highland Park. One year, it moved to Highland Park because there was a hurricane and a flood, and so it got canceled in Wasina. That year, actually, I think that year, the whole thing got canceled, or postponed at least. And then, like, 2 or 3 weeks later, it was like it was an indoor Pride event. And I don't really remember. I remember there being controversy about it, but I don't really remember how it played out. And then I think that was, after that happened, after it got flooded out, that was when it moved to Highland, I think, and stayed there for a number of years before going to Elmwood. So increasingly more visibility. You know, from Wasina, Highland was more visible than Wasina, and Elmwood, of course, more than Highland.
So, we're right about at an hour. How long did you remain involved in these organizations, I guess? So now we're talking about into the 90s. Were you still involved with the Blue Ridge Lambda Press, and there's the Pride organizing, which... I guess was ALGO was the official group doing that. How long did you remain involved in these different aspects of?
I got out of most of it in 90 or 91 because I started graduate school and I was working full time. So I was pulling back from things at that point. And I never really got very involved after that. When I finished in 93, I didn't really get involved after that.
What did you study? Where was that?
Social work. An MSW. I have a VCU degree, but at the time, Radford didn't have an MSW program, nor did any of the schools around here. So they had a remote program. And so all my classes were on the Radford campus. So the only time I ever set foot on VCU's campus was for a graduation ceremony. So I finished that in fall of 93, and then the ceremony was actually 94, spring graduation.
So I know that with Pride that I think it was mid-late 90s when Ronald Pride formed its own nonprofit and moved in that direction.
I'm not sure. I don't know. I was thinking, I would say later than, well, what did you say, the mid to late 90s?
Late
90s. Oh, well, yeah, that's probably about right.
And the Blue Ridge Lambda Press, that kept going and going. Who was, you know, was there an organization behind that in the moving into the 90s? Or?
I think it sort of became just its own entity, just kind of being carried along by whoever was involved with it at the time. I know that there were a couple of women who were quite involved with it later in the 90s. And then it just kind of petered out. I mean, I think there was a period of time, a year or two, where there were like maybe, you know, an issue every 3 or 4 months, something like that. And probably the last one was maybe, I don't know, 2006 or 7, somewhere in there. But I think I have all of them, like I said, so we can, you know, at some point we can pinpoint that.
I think you gave us the last few years. The ones that you donated went up to early 08.
Okay.
I imagine those were the last issues.
Okay. I think the ones I gave you were the ones I had more than one copy of, because I think I still have a full set of them. I want to mention one other thing, though, that hasn't come up. In maybe the mid-80s, a friend and I, good friend who has moved away too, formed the gay rap group. You haven't heard of a gay rap group? The gay rap group went on for many years, up until the early 90s, because I also withdrew from that at that point. So it went on for, well, how many years is that? Not that many years, I guess. It seems like it went on for about 10 years, but it was just that, just a rap group. You know, we didn't really have programs in particular. Usually had a dozen or so people there. I think it was almost always guys. We had probably had a few women, but not that many. And we met at, well, the first meeting, the first organizing meeting of that was going to be at my friend's apartment, and he lived out off of Hirschberger, and we had a terrible snowstorm that night, but we went anyway. There were a handful of us that went in the snow. And then it met twice a month in the evenings, on a Thursday night, maybe? I can't remember now. But, and we met at, what is it called? I want to say the Magdalen House, but that's not right. It's owned by the Catholic Diocese, and it's next door to Ram House on Campbell Avenue. What is that place called? The house was presided over by two or three women they weren't nuns, they were lay people, but they were like nuns in every way that I knew of, at least, except I know they weren't nuns. But they were very welcoming, and we would meet in one of the rooms there, and so we did that for years, and it was posted, the group was posted, and the P.O. box was posted in the newspaper and different places, and so we would get, you know, people would write into the P.O. box, and we'd write back and tell them the information, and then we had a lot of people over the years.
What was it called? It was called
the Gay Rap Group. Yep.
And what was your motivation to found it?
Well, just to create an alternative to the bars, I think was mainly it. And it was happening, you know, I could pinpoint the year that it started, but I can't. My best memory is that it was in the mid-80s. I remember there was one fellow whose name I don't remember, who I never met and never came to the meetings, but every so often he would send us a bunch of stamps because he knew we were doing all this stuff through the mail, and he would just, you know, that was his contribution.
Well, and what were the issues that you were taking up at the meetings? What were the
just what you would think? Just personal issues. Whatever you could think of, we talked about, but not political stuff. I mean, that probably, I'm sure, came up, but it was really just, you know, talking about struggles and relationships and, you know, frustrations and that kind of thing. I know of at least one couple who met there who are still together and who I'm still friends with. So that was nice.
Yeah, that's great. I hadn't heard of the gay rap group. So you met for, sounds like you met for almost 10 years in this Catholic space.
Yeah.
A support group.
Yeah.
Men and women.
I don't really remember women particularly being there. I mean, we were certainly open to that, but I don't think many women came. Now, there was another group that... There was a Dignity Integrity group you probably know Dignity Integrity. Dignity was a Catholic, gay Catholic support group, and Integrity was an Episcopalian support group. And I think they were national. I mean, it was like a national thing. You know, very informal, but, you know, that was nationally, they were, you know, across the nation, they were called those respectively. And there was kind of a combo group that met for at least a while at, I don't know if Catholics call it the manse, but on 419, right next to Our Lady of Nazareth. And I went to one of those meetings, I think only one, because I didn't have the religious angle. I remember when they started the meeting, they would have a prayer, and I remember waiting in the other room until the prayer was finished, and then I went in and joined the group. But I think, like I said, I think I only went to that once, and that was somewhere in the sometime in the 80s too, probably before the rap group.
So in conclusion, what would you say are some of the big changes in the LGBT community over time? I guess you were very involved in a lot of activities in the 80s and into the early 90s. What do you think is different since then? Is the community the same today, you'd say, as it was then? Or
no, it's not at all the same. I'm not convinced there really is a gay community anymore. Certainly not like there was in the 80s and 90s. Gosh, where to begin? It's just different in every way. I think that for my generation, of course, so many guys died from AIDS that put a huge dent in my generation. I think that Roanoke was and probably still is a place where kids who grow up and are gay move away and don't really come back much. I know that that happened, you know, in the 80s and 90s, and like I said, it still happens today, I'm sure. I mean, that happens to some extent in all subgroups in the Roanoke area and places like it, you know. People move away to bigger and better things. If you go to an event like Pride in the Park, these days, in the last number of years, I'll go there and see people that I've never laid eyes on before. And it used to, you know, I came up in a period where, you know, if there was somebody in town who was gay, you probably saw them, would recognize them, even if you didn't know them, because they would go to the bars, right? Of course, that was kind of a naive, because not everybody who was gay went to the bars, but, you know, probably most did. I think that it's women, gay women are more visible than gay men, and I think that's probably always been true to a degree, even though the women weren't going to bars and stuff so much here, but and I say more visible, I guess what I mean is they could exist with a level of acceptance that I think gay men didn't have in those years. But now, at say Pride in the Park, you see more women than men, and you see a lot of kids who you don't know what their persuasions are. You know, so I think that the gay community is blending into mainstream society, and it's meant huge changes. I think it's similar to what happened with integration. You know, that when integration occurred, a lot of the black institutions began to fail and began to decline. And, you know, the same thing I think has happened in the gay scene. I joke around with friends sometime and I say, you know, it was a lot more fun when we were oppressed. Because there was more of a scene, you know, there was more nightlife. And, you know, now the park is really not a gay bar anymore, not the way it was. And so, yeah, and a lot of people just don't go out. You know, or if they go out, they have their small groups and they go to this place or that place. But yeah, there's not really a central place now that you can go and for a social scene, which has been very hard for me. That's been very disappointing for me. I guess because I over relied on that throughout my adulthood. So that's hard. That's hard for me.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for the conversation and sharing your story.
My pleasure. Enjoyed it.